You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
There is violence against women in this episode. Please take care where and when you listen.
As strange as this story may seem, this is a work of nonfiction with no invented dialogue. Every reenactment you hear comes from government files, archives, diaries, letters, newspaper articles, books, or trial testimony. When George Connor sees the pearl-handled pistol in Imogene Remus's hand, he knows negotiations have broken down. For weeks, Connor had worked with his boss, George Remus, to fashion a divorce settlement that Imogene would accept. But tonight, she walks into the Cincinnati mansion unannounced and deeply aggrieved. And then she draws a gun.
I will settle this myself.
Connor's moves like lightning, wrestling the pistol and the handbag she had brought it in from Imogene's hand. He replaces the pistol back in her purse and lays it on the fireplace mantel. He gently grabs her shoulder and guides her away from Remus and into the library. He closes the door and faces her, waiting for her to speak. Alone with Connors, Imogene immediately grows hysterical, the expression on her face flashing from fury to gloom.
That man cannot treat me that way. He has abused me. He's been cruel and selfish. Without any justification, George has ruined my reputation.
She keeps ranting. Connors decides to stay quiet and let her finish. Then he speaks.
Are you finished? Look, if you would be reasonable and wanted a divorce, you could get it. You could get a much better settlement working directly with George instead of fooling around with your own lawyers and that boyfriend of yours, Franklin Dodge.
Imogene grimaces and glares at Connors. She is incensed, but doesn't say another word, just turns to leave the room. As she's walking toward the front door, Connors pushes past her toward the mantel. Quickly, before she can see him, he slips the revolver out of her purse and into his pocket. For now, at least, the pearl-handled pistol belongs to Remus. I'm Abbott Kaler, and this is Remus, the Mad Bootleg King. In 1934, Fiorella LaGuardia of airport fame would become one of New York City's most legendary mayors. But during Prohibition, he was a U.S. congressman. Representative LaGuardia hated Prohibition. His constituents were the immigrant communities of Lower Manhattan. He'd seen Prohibition steal their livelihoods. He'd seen the violence that came with the illegal liquor trade, and he would soon get the chance to tell the entire House of Representatives how he felt about it. LaGuardia had watched the prosecution of George Remus closely, and he believed that the Justice Department was sweeping its own corruption under the rug. And the worst examples of that corruption, in his eyes, were the disgraced Prohibition agent Franklin Dodge and his former boss, Assistant Attorney General Mabel Willebrand. Dodge was running around breaking laws with Imogene Remus, and Willebrand was preying on the people that LaGuardia represented. The congressman had had enough. LaGuardia stood as tall as his 5'2" frame would allow and held a sheaf of paperwork aloft like a weapon. Those papers had been given to him privately by George Connors, and all of them recounted the misadventures of Franklin Dodge.
Mr. Chairman and gentlemen, I do not desire at this time to start a debate on prohibition. Instead, I have some facts which tend to show a disgraceful disregard for the law on the part of officials who are or were responsible for its enforcement. When a prominent investigator in the Department of Justice leaves the United States government in order to go into the bootlegging business, it is about time Congress takes notice. In the early part of 1922, George Remus and others were tried and convicted on violations of the Volstead Act. The case was worked up by a Department of Justice agent, one Franklin L. Dodge, who took pride in making himself known as the ace of the Department of Justice.
LaGuardia spent the next 20 minutes alleging a different conspiracy, not by Remus and his associates, but by the Department of Justice. LaGuardia explained that after Remus was sent to the Atlanta Penitentiary, Dodge investigated corruption in the prison.
And while he was there, Franklin Dodge became very friendly with the wife of the prisoner Remus, and their conduct in the warden's office is too obscene to relate at this time.
To drive home the point, LaGuardia read a letter written by John Marshall, the prosecutor who had handled the Jack Daniels case. It was addressed to Marshall's boss at the Justice Department, Mabel Willebrand.
When we have a situation where a government agent works up a case and puts his man in jail, and while that man is in jail, he acquires the very same property for which this man was sent to jail and succeeds in having the Department of Justice prosecute this man and hold him while cases against others are dismissed, I think it is an outrageous condition, and I think some action should be taken.
Mabel Willebrand found herself in a dilemma. She was awash in documents recounting Dodge's misdeeds, but she knew she could never act on them. Prosecuting Dodge, or even publicly condemning his behavior, would highlight her own poor judgment in trusting him, a mistake for which she, as a woman especially, might not be forgiven. LaGuardia repeatedly harassed Willebrand's office, demanding Dodge's file. She refused. Meanwhile, J. Edgar Hoover launched a new investigation into Dodge, uncovering a variety of unscrupulous and possibly illegal behavior. In his report to Willebrand, Hoover included evidence that Dodge had handled and sold whiskey certificates in Cleveland 6 months before he resigned his position. And with his report, Hoover enclosed a personal note.
Needless to say, I'm astounded at some of the statements attributed to Dodge. Allegations made in the attached affidavits would indicate that Dodge has violated certain federal statutes. I would appreciate receiving your instructions as to the action you think should be taken.
Willebrand was direct in her response.
I do not think there is anything here on which action can be taken or future investigation based. Sale of whiskey certificates is accepted from the National Prohibition Act. It is not unlawful, and I see nothing else in this report on which we could base prosecution.
As if to validate her decision, she scrawled a note to herself on Hoover's memo.
There is nothing else.
Hoover disagreed. He had pledged to target corrupt agents regardless of their connections to powerful government officials. Even though Dodge was no longer with the Bureau, the director would continue the investigation on his own. 3 months later, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear Remus's final appeal, his last hope to avoid a jail sentence for the Death Valley nuisance conviction. On July 1st, Remus was driven to the Miami County Jail in Troy, Ohio. The warden led him to cell 13, where a guard handed him a blanket, a pillowcase, a sheet, a towel, and a tin cup. For the next year, he would own nothing else. From the first day, Remus's health began to deteriorate. His cell measured 4 by 8 feet, lit only by a sliver of glass etched along the roof, just enough to glimpse what he called the heavenly bodies above. Connors visited him as many as 5 times a week, and he feared for his friend's life. He assessed Remus's sallow skin, the way his once stout frame now seemed lost in his clothes. Remus declined every meal slid under his cell door. He couldn't stand the sight or scent of food. As the weeks rolled by, Remus became more estranged from reality. He became aware of a bizarre apparition. It wasn't like his brainstorms, which consisted of voices inside his head. This time, he said he could see the apparition. He called it a halo. It hovered brightly just above his head, vanishing and appearing at whim. This halo felt like electrical stars aligning in his mind, wresting control, directing and guiding him in the outside world. He claimed that the halo spoke in a language only he understood. It impelled him to do things. Back in Cincinnati, Remus's longtime watchman, William Muller, closely monitored the mansion. He recorded everything and everyone who came and went, including Imogene. She often brought a man Muller recognized, Franklin Dodge. One afternoon, he watched Imogene and Dodge carry every last plant from the home, reducing the lush, exotic atrium to a few stray twigs and leaves. They loaded the plants into Imogene's silver roadster, which, in homage to her husband, once had the initials GR imprinted on each door. Muller approached the car for a closer look. The original monogram had been removed and replaced with the initials FD in bright gilded lettering. Muller often spied Dodge staring down the driveway where the two stone lions Remus had installed still stood proud. After the couple stole the plants, they set about stripping the house room by room, item by item. Muller wrote down every piece as it passed through the front door and was loaded into a caravan of trucks. When Imogene and Dodge finished their work, even the lions were gone. When Remus was finally released from jail, he wanted only one thing, for Connors to take him home to the mansion so he could sleep in his own bed. As they pulled into the driveway, Remus saw that the house was completely dark and every door padlocked. He finally threw a brick through a window and scrambled inside. The house was bare. The only things left inside were a bed and a pair of Franklin Dodge's shoes. He staggered toward the indoor pool. If he closed his eyes, he could conjure the memory of New Year's Eve 1921, when he and Imogene hosted revelers from across the country to celebrate the new year and unveil the Imogene Baths. The two lovers had plundered it completely. The Grecian statues, the silver sconces, the priceless urns, gone. All that remained was the water, and he stood over it now, his rippled reflection gazing back, broadcasting his horror. He shouted maniacally at Connors.
"Well, she left the water. I think I'll hop in and take a swim."
In that moment, it was the funniest sentence he'd ever heard. His laugh started low in his gut and hit the air as a shriek, sliding up the scales and back down again, deepening into a sob. He fell to his knees, tears dropping through his fingers, and lost all sense of himself. Remus would have several more breakdowns about the plundering of his home, witnessed by many different people. Some would begin to question whether Remus was legitimately crazy or if the brilliant bootlegger knew exactly what he was doing. Remus's home was now nothing more than a skeleton, and George Connors knew he could not let his friend stay there. It took all of Connors' strength to pull Remus onto his feet and walk him to the car. As Connors drove, Remus screamed and raved, his neck veins engorged and his pupils sliding out of sight. Eventually, Remus's brainstorm passed, and Connors guided him to his bed. The next morning, Connors told Remus he could stay for as long as necessary. He tried to reanimate Remus and help him focus on the tasks at hand as the divorce trial approached. But every night, Remus would appear at Connors' bedroom door, mumbling about Imogene and Dodge.
"I see them right before me, all the time."
Every memory of Imogene became a ghost, and Connors knew well how terrified Remus was of ghosts. Remus hired private detectives and gave them two tasks: find his money and trail his wife and Dodge from city to city. If the detectives encountered them, they were to call Remus at once so that he could catch them together personally. One detective reported seeing Dodge and Imogene at the Roosevelt Hotel in New York City with a briefcase full of whiskey certificates. Remus boarded the next train east, only to be told upon arrival that the couple had just checked out. Another advised Remus to hustle to Canada. The couple had been spotted over the border with $100,000 worth of his securities. This time, Remus missed them by a half hour. He chased them to Washington, Detroit, St. Louis, Atlanta, and Chicago, but they were always one step ahead of him, robbing him of the chance to either gather evidence or, in Remus's words, crack a skull. Remus seethed with frustration and vented it to Connors.
If I ever meet Dodge, it'll be goodbye, Dodge.
Drama aside, tracking Imogene was a pointless exercise because she always turned up at her lawyer's office for divorce negotiations. She would sit across the table from Remus, a smug and wretched smile on her face, intensifying his fury. Their divorce hearings stretched over the summer and became progressively more absurd. Every week seemed to bring a new suit or countersuit or accusation of contempt. During one deposition, Remus lifted Imogene's lawyer from his seat and attempted to hurl him out the window. Following that outburst, Remus's own lawyers quit, and he announced that from now on, he would be representing himself. At the end of August 1927, Remus received a call from a Bureau of Investigation agent named Tom Wilcox. To Remus's delight, Wilcox explained that he was investigating Dodge per the orders of Director J. Edgar Hoover. Wilcox believed Dodge should be arrested and indicted for violating the National Prohibition Act. He wired his conclusions to Hoover, but again, Will and Brent refused to take action.
I know he is guilty of inexcusable conduct and transactions of a questionable nature, but his actions do not warrant criminal prosecution.
Before hanging up, Wilcox shared one last piece of news. There was a new plot afoot, set in motion by Imogene and Dodge, to murder Remus before the divorce trial. Remus immediately summoned Connors to the mansion.
My God, she surely is desperate, trying to kill me before the divorce case even takes place. You and I have got to watch ourselves, because sooner or later they are bound to get us.
Connors watched as Remus raved and tore around, pacing and rubbing his head and throwing his hands from side to side. Suddenly, he stood still again and turned to Connors.
They will never take me if I see them first.
Remus went straight to the butler's pantry, where he'd kept Imogene's pearl-handled revolver since the night Connors filched it from her purse. From that day forward, Remus carried the gun with him at all times.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between award-winning mattress brand Leesa and home design favorite West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is the culmination of these two companies' shared values: premium materials, meticulous craftsmanship, and sustainable practices. Made with natural latex, responsibly sourced natural wool, and environmentally safe foams, the Natural Hybrid elevates your sleep sanctuary. Indulge indulges your senses and supports a greener tomorrow. Plus, when you purchase the Natural Hybrid, you're also helping fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Since 2015, Lisa has donated more than 40,000 mattresses to ensure children and families have a safe place to sleep. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Lisa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit lisa.com/iHeart. That's LEESA.com/iHeart.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Harry Truesdale, a young man with receding hair and a thick build, had developed a certain reputation in the underworld. He was someone who could do the dirty work, the dirtiest work, in fact, contract killing. In August 1927, Truesdale got a tip about a job and drove to a dog track in Springdale, Ohio. In the grandstand, he felt a tap on his shoulder and turned to face a stranger, whose smile revealed a mouthful of gold teeth. The stranger leaned over and spoke quietly.
"Now I know how you could make $10,000. If you would kill a man, you could get that much money."
"I'm interested."
"I'll make the necessary introductions."
4 days later, Truesdale found himself outside of Imogene Remus's suite at Cincinnati's Hotel Alms. Imogene answered his knock and appraised Truesdale slowly, from his flat cap to his Oxfords. She curtly stated her business. She wanted him to kill George Remus. Truesdale would receive half of the fee from her and half from someone else.
"Who is this other party?"
"Franklin Dodge. I feel very bitter toward Daddy. My husband. I just wish someone would beat his brains out."
She handed him $250 for expenses.
"You'll get the rest when you bump off my husband."
Truesdale began tailing Remus, learning his schedule and habits. The hitman perched himself in a chair near the elevator bank in the Sinton Hotel, a spot with a clear view of Remus's suite. Once, when Remus left his door open a crack, Truesdale considered slipping into the suite and killing Remus on the spot. He watched Remus for 2 straight weeks, then visited Imogene at the Hotel Alms. When he arrived, he found her busy packing a suitcase.
"I'm going away. I'm going to Michigan."
She told Truesdale the time for waiting and watching was over. He needed to kill Remus right away, before the divorce trial started. She told him to call the Hotel Alms regularly to check in with her. The next day was October 4th, 2 days before the trial would begin. Truesdale drove 30 miles north to Hamilton, Ohio, where he knew Remus had some business. He watched Remus get into a limousine and head to the Grand Hotel, a well-known haunt for bootleggers. He called Imogene. She told him she would meet him outside the Grand Hotel at midnight, sharp. At the appointed hour, as Truesdale walked toward Imogene, he noticed a man across the street, tall and broad and backlit by the moon.
"Is that man with you?"
"He is. That's Franklin Dodge. It's the same man who's going to give you $5,000.
Imogene and Truesdale entered the Grand Hotel to scan the register, checking for Remus's name or a name written in his handwriting. They found neither, so they decided to wait outside. Hopefully, they would catch him coming or going. Within a moment, a car filled with men pulled up next to Dodge. Imogene excused herself, walked over, and poked her head into the car. When she returned to Truesdale, she was carrying a pistol. Truesdale had a sudden and disturbing thought. Imogene never intended to pay him. She had never mentioned any associates besides Franklin Dodge, and yet there was a car full of men across the street who were aware of their plans. In fact, at this point, it was fair to assume that Imogene was planning to double-cross him, either killing him to ensure his silence or turning him into the police anonymously as a hired gun. He had failed to execute the plan on her schedule. He knew too much and had done too little. As they talked, Truesdale watched her play with the gun in her lap, turning it over, running a finger along the barrel. He felt a hot stab of fear.
If I see him now, I will kill him myself.
They sat and waited, but Remus never appeared. Imogene decided to return to Cincinnati with Dodge. She told Truesdale to stay behind and keep watch. When Dodge's taillights faded into the distance, Truesdale drove back to Cincinnati with an entirely different plan. The next afternoon, one day before the divorce trial, Remus heard a knock on the door of his suite at the Sinton Hotel and found a young man at the door. He introduced himself as Harry Truesdale and said it was imperative that they talk. He was there with a warning. His wife wanted him dead. Truesdale filled Remus in on all the details. When he finished, Remus jumped from his chair and began raving. He ran across the room like he was going to jump out of the window. Truesdale didn't know which Remus was more dangerous, George or Imogene. A few hours after Harry Truesdale left, Remus called his driver for a ride back to the Price Hill mansion. Remus was quiet until they pulled up into the driveway. Then he gave the driver an order.
Be here in the morning about 7 o'clock. You will take me to the Hotel Alms. I want to see my wife before the trial starts. I want to talk things over with her.
In the morning, Remus dressed himself for the big trial, selecting a chocolate brown suit. He chose a fedora with the brim turned down instead of his usual bowler. No underwear, as always. And his blue Buick was parked in the driveway, driver at the ready. By 7:30 a.m., they had arrived at the Hotel Alms and parked at the corner. It was rush hour, and a stream of pedestrians crowded around the hotel, the ladies in cloche hats and the men in garish ties, all full of direction and purpose. Cars swerved and honked along Victory Parkway, Model Ts and Packards merging and accelerating. From the back seat of the Buick, Remus had a clear view of the entrance. If he did nothing, he would be divorced within 90 minutes. Later, Remus would say it was about that time when the halo appeared above his head and shooting stars launched into an orbit around him, and his mind began speaking to him in that odd language, the words forming a directive he had no choice but to obey. He spoke to his driver.
When she comes out, you call her. I want to talk to her. I want to talk to her on the outside.
Suddenly there she was, wearing a black silk dress and matching turban. A small purse dangled from her forearm. Remus clocked every movement of her swinging limbs, the way she drew the sun spotlight. Her daughter Ruth walked alongside her. Tomorrow would be his stepdaughter's 20th birthday, a maddeningly exact replica of her mother in both appearance and temperament. Ruth, too, wanted nothing to do with him. Remus's eyes shifted back to Imogene, who was smiling and laughing. The halo sent him a message.
That answers it.
Before Remus's driver could call out to Imogene, she and Ruth disappeared into a taxicab. Remus barked an order.
Catch that car!
His driver obliged, lunging and lurching, gaining speed as Imogene's taxi raced into Eden Park. Remus's car charged up to the taxi's bumper. Through the cab's rear window, Remus could trace the outline of Imogene's head, the curve of her shoulder. He imagined a revolver in her handbag, a bullet ready for him. His halo intensified. The stars shot faster and brighter, a fireworks display that only he could see. Remus was almost on her now, both cars hurtling toward Mirror Lake. With one last push, he passed her, taking in her face as he blurred by. His driver swerved to a stop 5 feet in front of the cab, making a T and trapping her. He watched as Imogene leapt from the cab, graceful even in terror. Ruth followed, exiting from the same door. Imogene frantically pushed her back inside, then sprinted down the road toward the Spring House gazebo. A pink slip peeked out from beneath the hem of her dress. Remus walked after her, his steps quickening, his halo blazing. He could hear her breath coming in stunted gasps. She was an arm's length away. He reached and caught her by her lovely wrist. He held her tight as she twisted and turned. From a distance, it might have looked as if they were dancing. She spun back toward him and stayed still this time, raising her face to his. He reached into his jacket pocket. The smooth pearl handle of Imogene's pistol felt cool against his palm.
Daddy, dear, I love you. Daddy, dear, don't do it.
But Remus heard the voice in his head speaking to him.
She who dances down the primrose path must die on the primrose path.
Remus shoved the gun so deeply into her gut that he barely heard the shot. A flock of birds launched themselves from the trees and scattered overhead. She fell against him and slid down, leaving a thin stripe of blood on his pants. Remus felt a yanking at his elbow. Turning halfway, he saw Ruth, her face contorted as she screamed.
Do you know what you were doing?
As Ruth tried to hold Remus still, her mother rose to her feet and began to run. Remus broke free and started after her. From the side of his cab, Imogene's cab driver saw her coming down the hill, a ring of blood blooming across her abdomen. Remus followed, his steps long and deliberate, his gait steady. His left hand still gripped the gun. Imogene faced the oncoming traffic and summoned the strength to scream.
My God! Somebody help! This man is killing me! I'm shot! Help me! I'm shot terrible bad!
A long queue of cars had stopped, their drivers watching in horror, but no one moved to help. Imogene yanked on the door of an idling car, but the driver refused to unlock it. She tried the next car. This time, the driver flung his door open and told her to get in. She had just enough energy left to slump into the seat. Ruth slid in beside her and propped her mother up, cupping her under the shoulders.
Drive straight ahead! Take her to the hospital!
The driver began speeding away. Ruth wrapped her arms around her mother and sobbed into her shoulder. Remus looked down at his hand and realized he was no longer holding the gun. His driver was nowhere to be found. He strolled past the gazebo where Imogene had fallen moments earlier, followed the bend in the reservoir, and found himself on Martin Drive. The sidewalk was lined with flowers in their final bloom and trees just beginning to brown. He quickened his pace to a near jog, veering crookedly along the path, as though he were both in a hurry and helplessly lost. A passing driver noticed Remus, assumed he was running late for something, and guided his car to the path.
Can I give you a lift?
Remus hurried to the car.
Yes, I got lost in the park.
He settled into the back seat and said he'd like to go to the Pennsylvania Depot.
Beautiful morning. Thank you for the lift. What a beautiful morning it is.
At the Pennsylvania Depot, Remus thanked the man for the ride and then went inside to call a cab. He told the driver to take him to the Cincinnati Police Department's Central Station, where he arrived at 8:30 a.m. Officer Frank McNeil was on duty.
I just shot my wife and I came to surrender. My name is George Remus.
Where did this occur?
Somewhere on the driveway in Eden Park.
What did you do with the gun?
I lost that in the scuffle.
Remus began to pace, walking to one end of the room, pivoting on a heel, and striding back. McNeil asked him to stand still and answer questions, but Remus wouldn't stop walking.
How many times did you shoot?
I don't know. I think three times. The gun jammed on me, so.
What became of her?
Remus shrugged, tilted his head toward the ceiling, and smiled.
This is the first piece I've had in 2 years and a half.
During the drive to the hospital, Ruth's mother grew heavier in her arms. Imogene's dress was scorched where the bullet had entered. Ruth tried not to look at the wound, but she would never unsee all that blood, rivulets streaming down her mother's steel-gray stockings, seeping into her patent leather pumps. Ruth wanted her to speak, to say something, anything, just a small promise that there remained enough of her to save.
I know I'm dying.
Oh, Mother! No, you are not.
Yes, I am. Isn't George terrible for doing this? I'm dying. Be a good girl.
The Ford carrying Imogene stopped at a light on the corner of Locust and Gilbert, where a police officer named William Knight stood on traffic duty. He heard a scream and saw a young woman leaning out her window, waving him over.
My mother is shot!
Night Salt Imogene on the back seat's floorboard. Her chin was on the seat and her legs were folded. She was kneeling in a pool of her own blood.
Who shot you?
George. Remus.
Knight knew the name.
Your husband from Price Hill?
Yes.
Knight let himself into the car, sitting next to the driver, who took off again. He rotated in his seat and continued talking to Imogene, hoping to keep her alert. They pulled into Bethesda Hospital. Knight checked his watch. 8:20 a.m. He lifted Imogene from the car, her bloody body imprinting on his. Ruth scrambled from her seat, dashed into the hospital, and returned with a wheelchair. On the way, Knight studied Imogene's wound and saw the jagged hole in her dress, singed by gunpowder. She had been shot at point-blank range. At the commotion, Imogene stirred and looked up at Officer Knight.
Do you think I'm going to die?
It was the last thing she ever said.
On this date, November 25th, 1927, this session of the Criminal Division of Common Pleas Court in Hamilton County will come to order.
I call Ruth Remus to the stand. Had your father made any threats against your mother?
In the past 2 years, continually. He said he would follow her to the ends of the earth and see that she didn't have a dime or thread of reputation left.
When you got up on the morning of the divorce hearing, was it your plan to go to the courthouse?
Yes, sir.
Did you see Remus in his car?
Just as we approached the bridge, Mother said, "There is Remus." Her first instinct was pleasure. She was pleased to see him. Her eyes sparkled. I think her impression was that he was coming to try to make up.
Next time on the finale of Remus, the Mad Bootleg King.
This decomposed mass of clay and her pimp broke up my home. And now I've gone from George Remus, the millionaire, to George Remus, the murderer.
Call the jury.
The claim of the defense is that the defendant was insane at the time the crime was committed.
Remus, the Mad Bootleg King is a co-production of iHeart Podcasts and School of Humans. It's hosted by me, Abbott Kaler. Chuck Reese and I wrote the show. Our producer is Miranda Hawkins. Our senior producer is Jessica Metzger. Executive producers are Virginia Prescott, Brandon Barr, Elsie Crowley, and Jason English. Sound design and mix by Chris Childs. Elise McCoy composed original music. Additional scoring by Chris Childs. Voices in this episode provided by Ben Bolin, Lauren Vogelbaum, Julia Criscal, Noel Brown, Matt Frederick, James Morrison, Miranda Hawkins, Nate Beagle, Mike Coscarelli, Judah Andrews, Zubin Hensler, Charles Edwards, Brittany Wilkerson, Tiago Macklin, Fleet Cooper, and Jeremy Fall. Casting support services provided by Breakdown Services. Special thanks to John Higgins from CuriosityStream and the team at CDM Studios in New York. If you're a fan of the podcast, please give it a review in your podcast app. You can also check out other Curiosity podcasts to learn about history, pop culture, true crime, and more.
School of Humans.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.